Okay, thanks very much, Ken, for the nice introduction and for the organizing the visit. It's been a pleasure to be here discussing exciting science in this great department. So what I'll try to tell you a little bit about today is about our attempt to understand materials. Material processing historically has been really a craft, and over many, many, many centuries. Eventually, experimentalists took over that business, and it really became an experimental science. And theories really play sort of a supporting role, but slowly we're sort of trying to compete with the experimentalists, and we're sort of developing tools for trying to do that. So this is going to be the story of how we're trying to struggle with understanding nature. And understanding nature really requires two types of efforts. We need to develop the right ideas how to think about complex materials, and we need to develop techniques for computing and predicting their properties. So the way I think of theory now is that it's not yet perfected. It's way behind the experiments, but we're sort of struggling to create something like a compass which is going to guide us in the search for more interesting materials. And that's sort of going to be the theme of the talk. And I'm going to start really from the very beginning, because this is a sort of a colloquium. We'll start with the 20th century physics. And we're going to start with the basics of Band theory and Landau-Fermi liquid theory. In the 20th century, after the development of quantum mechanics, physicists figure out that in many, many materials, we can understand their properties by thinking in terms of free electrons. So I'm assuming that you know that if you have free electrons, the electron in a solid behaves like a wave, and its properties, its states, can be described in terms of Schrödinger type-like of equations. If you think about it, one particle equations. If you think about it, it's really remarkable because the electrons interact via the Coulomb interactions, but by some miracle, it happens that that Coulomb interactions washes out. It becomes essentially zero in some energy range where you do the experiments, and that's what Landau figured out, and it's called Landau-Fermi liquid theory. The next step was to exploit that and learn how to calculate that, and there came Walter Kahn and Lu Sham, which figure out that basically, in this region where the electron really behaves as free, but with parameters which contain their interactions, one can actually develop very powerful computational tools for deriving their properties. And that's what's called density functional theory, which says that the energy is extremized as a function of the density. And that leads to some Schrödinger-like equation for some effective particles, which are the Kohn-Sham particles, with some eigenvalues, which are called the Kohn-Sham eigenvalues. This is like Hartree-Fock theory, where you have some potential, which is a functional of the density, and you sort of solve this set of equations self-consistently. And then from there, we can get the energy of the material. And then it turns out that these eigenvalues, well, not the true excitations of the solid, are sufficiently close to them that we can actually do perturbation theory near there, perturbation theory in the Coulomb interactions, and start calculating things. And that's the success story of the 20th century, the density functional theory, which allows us to understand many, many materials, materials important such as silicon or gold, which are the basis of the whole industry, the basis of the computers that we have. And the important thing is that we have now a reference frame for thinking about weakly correlated materials in terms of these entities, these particles. We have a starting point for thinking about the physics of these solids, and we do perturbation theory in the Coulomb interactions, and we can compute corrections to these eigenvalues, and the program is very, very successful. Just to give you an idea, if you just put here all the experimental values in the y-axis, and actually in the x-axis, and they evaluate it in the y-axis, then you see that if you just do the zeroth order, which is the LDA, we tend to underestimate the gaps of the semiconductors. But then when you just put the first order correction, it's in a straight line. And those calculations have no adjustable parameters. The only input is the structure of the solid. So this is a success story because we can actually understand conceptually the material, and we can also predict their properties. Okay, so this is 20th century physics. We can also compute almost anything you would like, transport optical properties, the vibration frequencies. It's a great story. Then come materials for which this standard model of solid-state physics actually doesn't apply. Those are materials where, for some reason, this thing that was so successful in semiconductors, in metals, doesn't work even qualitatively. For example, the copper oxides, which came as a complete shock to the community because nobody expected that oxides would actually be high-temperature superconductors. And this is sort of a famous phase diagram of the copper oxides. They have antiferromagnetism. They have high-temperature superconductivity. But the thing which really baffled the physics community is that the resistivities of these materials was gigantic. Here's the resistivity multiplied by a small number, which is the number of holes. And it turns out that these resistivities are so large that if you want to interpret in terms of lambda or quasi-particles, in terms of waves, you have to conclude that the mean free path of those quasi-particles is shorter than their wavelength, which cannot possibly be, which indicates really that this is really the wrong framework for thinking about all this. Not only the theory of BCS did not predict the superconductivity in something like lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide, but it doesn't even serve as the zeroth order point for calculating any of its properties. So that's what I call the failure of the standard model in solid-state physics, and that sort of drove the whole community to try to find some alternative for the Kohn-Sham system. In physics, we always need some zeroth-order Hamiltonian that we can solve to start thinking about the problem. In quantum mechanics, it was the hydrogen atom. Once you solve the hydrogen atom, you can think of more complex atoms in terms of hydrogen-like orbitals. In quantum mechanics, it was the harmonic oscillator. Many, many systems you can think in terms of an harmonic oscillator where you add perturbatively some non-linearities. In the standard model of solid-state physics, the Fermi gas was the zeroth-order thing, and then this perturbation theory in the Skrin-Coulomb interactions drove us to the right answer. Now, for the strongly correlated materials, we are searching, and it's sort of a challenge to construct some equivalent starting point to start thinking about the problem. And I just want to stress that this is not unique to cuprates. Almost any oxide has gigantic resistivities which cannot be interpreted in terms of waves, and it requires some other picture of the electron to think about the problem. Okay, so now, how do we start thinking? I said there's a problem to start thinking about the electron. The question is, how do we, when we don't have that concept, what can the experimentalists do to help us? And experimentalists have developed a lot of spectroscopies, a lot of tools to try to investigate what electrons are doing. What are the excitations of the electrons? And one of them, which is very successful, is called photoemission, where you just shine light and try to eject electrons. And what it measures is what is sort of the probability of removing an electron with some momentum k and some energy omega. If you have a weakly correlated material, such as gold or such as a semiconductor, then you find that for each wave vector, there's an energy which corresponds to this quasi-particle energy. So you have a nice dispersion relation here that tells you the energy as a function of wave vector of the wave. Now, in the case that you have strong correlations and the standard model fails, this function is a mess, and we need some other framework to think about it. But still, experimentalists can measure it, and that's sort of our challenge. We need to we need to express what happens when we try to remove an electron with energy omega and wave vector k. What's the amplitude for doing that? So this is what I call the weak correlated situation, where the band theory or the standard model works. And this is sort of the strong correlation situation, where perturbation theory doesn't work and we need something else. And of course, we have many other spectroscopies, and we'll see that basically the experimentalists are using everything they can to try to solve experimentally the strong correlation problem. Another thing which is useful is the angle integrated spectra. Well, now I average over k, and I ask the question, what is the amplitude for adding or removing an electron from the solid? That's called the spectral function, angle integrated. And it's like a density of states. So now we think in real space, what's the probability of adding an electron at one position in space or removing it at some position in space? And when the situation is weakly correlated, it's just the density of states of those Kohn-Sham quasi-particles. When the material is very, very strongly correlated, it looks something different. And it turns out that in that case, it's better to think in terms of an atomic picture, and the features that you see in the photoemission can be interpreted as the eigenlevels of an atom. These things are called Haber bands, and this is the energy for removing an electron and the energy for adding an electron. So this is the ionization potential, and this is the affinity energy of the atom, and this is called, in the jargon of correlated electrons, the Haber U. Now, this is not the only tool. The experimentalists like also to shine light on a problem, and this is called optical conductivity. And basically, they measure what is the probability of absorbing a photon. Adding the integrating over frequency tell us something about how many carriers we have in the material. And something very striking, which happens in many correlated electron materials, is that the number of carriers depends strongly on temperature. For example, in the material which is called iron silicide, people have measured up to 5 electron volts, and they find that when you lower the temperature, you remove carriers, and presumably they go to some very, very high energy, but they cannot find where those carriers go. So that's something else that cannot be explained in terms of the standard model of solids, because it's something qualitative that carriers are lost to very high energy. Namely, there's a very non-local transfer in spectral weight. In the standard model of solids, if you remove spectral weight from some energy range, you have to put it somewhere else. And that's just two examples, optical spectroscopy, photoemission spectroscopy. The experimentalists have really used everything they have at their disposal. They throw X-rays, they throw neutrons, the whole kitchen sink to try to solve this problem. And we have a ton of data, and it's a challenge for the theorists to keep up with what we, and provide, really shine light on the problem. Okay, so I told you a little bit about strong correlations. I have not told you yet how to make them. Now, it turns out that there's a very simple recipe, like, go to your kitchen, mix this, mix that, to make correlated materials. All you need to do is find places in the periodic table where we have some open shell. So we can look in the transition metal region, we can use the rare earths, or we can go down to the actinides. Every time that the atoms form an open shell, you're likely to find materials where the atomic character of the electron persists, and therefore the band picture actually fails to work. Now, sometimes the elements overlap a lot among themselves, and still, therefore they're not correlated, but in that case, there's a simple solution. You just put them a little bit further apart by putting them in some cage with either arsenic or oxygen, whatever you like, to separate them so that they can retain their atomic character, and then you made for yourself a strongly correlated material. And this is sometimes it's useful to layer them and put things in a layer, just like when you make a sandwich, you can put stuff in there so it tastes better. You can do that with these materials, and that's basically how you make tons of interesting materials, which turn out to be very useful. So just to give you an example, let's just assume that we're going to put oxygen to separate the transition metals, and let's sort of walk through one row of the periodic table, and you'll recognize that these things that do all sorts of useful stuff. If you start with vanadium oxide, then you find a material which has a room temperature metal insulator transition. You can use that if you want to make smart windows to reflect heat when it gets hot, but still get the light through. If you go to chromium, then you get chromium dioxide. It's actually half metal. People used to use that to make tapes for recording. If you use manganese, then you got what's called the colossal magnetoresistance. It's something that has a huge sensitivity to magnetic fields. The resistivity changes a lot for when you change the magnetic field. Giant magnetoresistance gave Albert Fehr the Nobel Prize, and so on and so forth. Every time that you just sort of add something, add some oxygen or some nictite to this, you get something which is spectacularly interesting. For example, if you work with cobalt, the lithium cobalt oxide is what everybody has in his cell phone. It's the prime material for batteries, and the copper oxides are the high temperature superconductors. So the recipe works well. But the really important question is not how to find correlated electron materials. We know how to do that. It's how to find the really interesting ones, the ones that give you Nobel Prizes. And for that, there's also a recipe which involves, in fact, two steps. The first one is called serendipity, and the second one is the disodian approach. So you combine these two things, and then you find an interesting correlated material. Serendipity, of course, is basically sheer luck. The Edisonian approach is a little bit more complicated because people think that Edisonian approach is trial and error. And in fact, Edison really tried lots of things, more than hundreds of substances, before he decided that carbon was good to making microphones. But I looked it up in Wikipedia, and it says that really the historical record indicates that Edison's approach was much more sophisticated than that. And in fact, he would use any available theory, and trial and error was really the last resort. So I sort of think that basically he would be now using a lot of computation in his search. And this method really works. And over the years has resulted in fascinating compounds, not just the ones I showed you, but you can have large volume collapses in materials you can use for piezoelectrics. You can get ultra strong magnets with rare earths, the ones that now the Chinese are hoarding and the Japanese are craving for. You have things which are called heavy fermions, which are materials whose masses are like the 1,000 times the mass of the electrons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You have new phenomena every few years. So the last one in this series is the iron arsenides, which turned out to be superconductors. This was discovered in the group of Hideo Hosono, and the group was very well funded to try to find transparent conductors. Transparent conductors are basically insulating materials at high energy, so they have to have a large energy gap, but they have to have some DC conductivity. And they were looking for that, and that's why they were exploring these materials. It turned out that these are high temperature superconductors. So there you have the serendipity approach. Once they find that, over a few months, they try every possible substitution, like Edison taught us, and then you manage to raise the critical temperature, usually by a factor of 2 or 3. And that happens over a period of a few months. Now the record is about 56 degrees Kelvin. So this is sort of this method at work, and it's sort of very good. The only problem is that the serendipity part, it's slightly slow. Okay, so then we want to do theory. And we would like sort of now to build some method to help our experimentalist friends approach in a more effective way this thing, or at least understand these materials. Because what I said is what we need is a framework to think about this correlated problem. We need something to replace those Kohn-Sham waves, which are a very, very bad starting point for correlated materials. So here, so one idea that we sort of followed is to try to do what people did in statistical mechanics, which is if you have a problem that involves many, many bodies, you try to replace it by an effective single-site problem in a medium. And if you have an Ising model, you know the Weiss mean field theory. What Weiss told us is that if you have spins which interact among themselves, that's the Ising model that all the students learn in StatMech, you can learn a lot about it by replacing all the spins except for one by an effective spin. So that's sort of the idea of mean field theory for a classical problem. Our problem is that this problem is quantum mechanical. It's not classical, and therefore, but we can sort of follow the same strategy. So what we need to do is we need to go back and think about the solid as a collection of atoms. So no matter what solid you have, we know it's made from atoms. And if we want to make a mean field theory, what we need to do is we need to select one atom. And then after we select the atom, we're going to replace all the others by a medium. So this is sort of a cartoon of what's called the Haber model, which is just something which only has s electrons as carriers. So if you have an atom, it can only be in four states. It can be empty, up, or down, or doubly occupied. And your atom has only four states, so it will fluctuate quantum mechanically between those four states. Now, the rest of the lattice serves as a reservoir of electrons, and that's sort of the medium of the quantum theory. And there is some amplitude or hybridization for transfer electrons from the medium to the atom, and that's what's called the hybridization. So that's the mean field cartoon of a solid, and it's entirely similar to this mean field cartoon of a magnet. The only difference is that the atom is quantum mechanical, and the reservoir is also quantum mechanical. And what it does, the mean field, this amplitude tells us how well the electron can move through the lattice. If these amplitudes are very large, the electron can run up to infinity and come back. If these amplitudes are zero, the electron is stuck. So essentially, we have quantified in here the notion of itinerancy or metallicity. We found the right order parameter, if you want, to quantify itinerancy. And then we did a self-consistency condition to determine this medium. And we go back then to inspiration by density functional theory. The Kohn-Sham system was supposed to give us the right density. Dynamical mean field theory is supposed to give us the right spectral function. So if we request that this problem gives us the true spectral function of the solid, we arrived to some self-consistency condition for this medium, and those are the DMFT equations. So that's our main tool, and I'm not supposed to show any equations, but for each thing here, there's an equation that you can go and can work out, so I will just not show it. Okay, so now let's do things with this model. And we're looking still at this toy model, which only has s electrons, has only one parameter, how much it costs us to put two s electrons on the same site. But it turns out that it has an interesting phase diagram. And the interesting phase diagram, when the correlations or this u is small, gives us essentially weakly interacting quasiparticles. When u is large, gives us an insulator, and it tells us a lot how we go from one regime to the other. And that's interesting because this is sort of like a guidance for real materials. And what happens is that we think of them in terms of these spectral functions I introduced before and which are measured in photoemission. And this is sort of called quasiparticles. Those are well-defined entities in k-space. Those are the atomic-like excitations and the Kohl-Haber bands. And this gives us the concepts to think about what happens when we vary the correlations. And when we vary the correlations, basically we sort of transfer weight from one energy region to the next. And we can go from a Fermi liquid to a bad metal where we lose quasiparticles and we gain Haber bands. Then if we crank up the correlations more, then we have basically a gap here. We have what's called a bad insulator. Eventually, when u is very large or the temperature is small, we have a Mott insulator. So this is like the phase diagram of our Ising model. it gives us the conceptual tools for thinking of an electron which is neither itinerant nor localized, or is perhaps both itinerant and localized. It just behaves differently at different energy scales. This was a cartoon. There's no material that looks like the Hubbard model, but it helped us introduce some concepts to think about real solids. Now, this research was done in 1995. That was the thesis of Marcelo Rosenberg. And at that time, there was very little indication that any of these things existed in nature. But, and also, we didn't have the right to expect that these things would be seen in nature. But still, we sort of realized that this phase diagram looks very similar to the phase diagram of many substances, where you can vary the correlations by changing pressure, the canonical one being the vanadium oxide system. And then in sort of theory and experiment always go hand in hand, and various studies of vanadium oxide show that they display qualitatively the properties of this phase diagram. So let me just sort of give you some examples, starting with optical spectroscopy that was done by Gordon Thomas at Bell Labs. This is sort of the optical spectroscopy, sigma of omega of vanadium oxide at two temperatures. So vanadium oxide was roughly here. We changed the temperature a little bit, and we get a law of transfer spectral weight. This is the difference of the spectra at two temperatures. Just like the theory said, when you cool the system, you build low energy spectral weight. And this is a rescale of a volt, so that's something that you cannot explain using a standard model, but came out of the theory and it was sort of like a prediction. The photoemission was a little bit harder. I mean, the early photoemission results didn't show any support for the theory. It only showed the Hubbard bands. It was the green curve, but then the experimental techniques of photoemission improved and people went to higher energy to probe deeper into the bulk of the material. It turned out that this was a surface active artifact. When you go deep into the bulk, then you start seeing both the quasi-particle and the Hubbard bands. And as the experiments progress, you get closer to the theory. Now, you go from a metal to an insulator. There's here a critical point. The group in Orsay actually measured carefully what happens near that critical point. Turned out to be very similar to the predictions of a theory, an Ising type of singularity, for example, in resistivity. And this phase diagram has physical reality in the sense that here you have a first order phase transition, and you can see really in experiment the two spin orders. So that was sort of a real success story of the theory. And it's based on some high temperature universality, which is going on, that if you don't look at the low temperature details, the phase diagram really is a phase diagram which is a generic phase diagram of a correlated material. Okay, so, but strictly speaking, we don't have the right to claim that we really predicted that because it was sort of a generic phase diagram. So we need to extend that to real materials. And that was sort of the next step, which is sort of called the realistic dynamical mean field theory. And what I would like to do now is I'd like to give you some examples from real materials where instead of just treating this cartoon model, which only has s electrons, we really treat the full electronic structure of the material with the correlations, and we do the dynamical mean field theory for it. There's no difficulty except for technical difficulties. We sort of think of a solid as really made out of atoms, but now we take the real atoms and the real solid into consideration. And I'll show you now some examples. The first one taking from the heavy fermions, which is, those are the materials which get extremely heavy at low temperatures. And this is sort of the structure of the material. And we know that they're heavy because they have very large specific heats of the order of 100 times what you would expect just from the standard model considerations. And this was actually motivated by experiments, and Ken was doing that, I think, as part of his thesis in San Diego. What these experiments showed is that at high temperatures, you just have basically a very, very broad feature here, which is called a Drude peak. And you can understand that as electrons, which are sort of scattered by something, by disorder or by spin fluctuations. But as you lower the temperature, and you see that also in the resistivity, something dramatic is happening here because you're starting to open some gap, you're developing some narrow features, and even more interesting, you know, because this has to match to the DC, that this is trying to build an extremely narrow peak at low energies, just they didn't have the resolution to see that, but we know that something fantastic has to happen at zero frequency. So that was sort of the background, and we sort of can do that also theoretically, and we observed that remarkably, when we put the electronic structure, it looks exactly like the experiment, too good to be true in the sense that high temperatures, we have some very, very scattered metal, and then as we lower the temperature, we start building various features which are seen experimentally, plus this very narrow peak, and we can do a little bit better than the experimentalist and see this build up. But theory is not just reproducing experiment. I mean, this has no adjustable parameters, but it's understanding where it comes from. And that's where the dynamical mean field theory is so powerful, because it allows us to understand linked structure with property. Since we really start from the structure of the material, then we can actually see where things are coming from. And we go in various steps. So this is the input to the programs. We just put all the atoms in the right places. Then we evaluate the photoemission spectroscopy, and we see how these heavy particles form. There's a remarkable change which is going on in the temperature, in the nature of those electrons when we go from 300 Kelvin to 10 Kelvin, and it's cast in exactly the same language that the experimentalists talk about. This is sort of the photoemission. Here we look at the SPD electrons which are in the solid, and we see that at high temperatures, they form some bands which are sort of strongly scattered. That's responsible for this through the peak. Then we cool the system. Remarkably, some gaps open. And the surprising thing is there are actually two gaps that open, which give rise to these two features. And we can trace them to the presence of two indium sites in the material. So somehow, we can understand the chemical handle that governs these gaps as being due to the fact that there is one indium here and one indium there, and we understand what sort of the chemical handle that we need in order to tune this material, make it more localized or more itinerant. We sort of get a complete understanding of how the electronic structure of this material gets transformed as we change the temperature in the system. Okay, so now let me give you another example, taking now from the 5F systems. And this is, sort of, again, a very, very old problem, what happens when you move along the actinide series. The actinide series starts with actinium. That's why it's called actinides. But then it goes through uranium, neptunium, plutonium. Here we have the volume of the element. And when you go through delta plutonium, there's something very interesting. There's a jump here in the volume. And people knew for many years that the reason for that is that here, the F electrons, as you fill the shell, don't participate in the bonding. So that's why the volume doesn't depend on the number of F electrons. Well, here, as you add more F electrons, you form bands, and therefore you bond, and therefore the volume gets smaller. And these are huge changes of volume of the order of 10%. So you can actually see this. This is a 30% change of volume. You can see that with your naked eye. And in between, there is delta plutonium, which is the most mysterious of all elements. People think that the nuclear physics of plutonium is complicated. That was completely understood, in fact, many, many years ago. The solid-state physics of this material, with all the phases it has, it still remains a completely open problem up to today. And you see that something funny is happening if you look how the specific heat is behaving as I move in the series, and you see that when I start getting to here, the specific heat gets very large, which means that the particles here are getting very heavy. So that was sort of a chance to flex our muscles and deal with this problem, because as you can understand, this is an important substance, and it had been studied with all the traditional methods, and it was not possible to even get the right volume or any of the physical properties of this material right with this method. So it was sort of a challenge for dynamical mean field theory. And also, we were sort of lucky that this was the only element, really, whose phonon spectra had not been measured. That's why, because it's very easy to measure the phonon spectra. The experimentalists have all these toys that any substance they can measure with neutrons, they can measure the phonon spectra in a matter of hours. But for plutonium, there's a problem because it's known to absorb neutrons, so you cannot do that with neutron spectroscopy. Also, it's hard to get crystals because of its radioactivity. So we were able to actually calculate the physical properties of this, and in particular predict the phonon spectra. So that was the first time I computed the phonon spectra. And it had all sorts of weird properties. For example, the acoustic mode and the optical mode are degenerate. There are kinks in various places. It was sort of an interesting thing. And we published this in Science. And in a few months later, the experiment came. And it's sort of interesting because if you look at the comparison of theory, which are the black dots with the experiment, which was done by the group of Wong et al. A few months later, you see that overall, for a theory without parameters, the agreement was quite good, even though there are places where there are clear discrepancies. The way that the experimentalists get around the problem of having a neutron absorption and small crystals is by using a new technique, which is the measurement of phonons using X-ray, resonant X-rays. So you can, now the resolution of the experiment is such that with kilo electron volt X-rays, you can measure things in the infrared, in terahertz. So you can measure milli electron volt energy changes by shooting kilo electron volt X-rays. So that's what we're competing with in this field of correlated electrons. The experimentalists have very, very powerful techniques. And the theory and experiment went really very nicely together. And again, with dynamical mean field theory, we can not only in this case predict something, but we can understand where it comes from. Plutonium has all these changes in volume, all these phases at near room temperature. Where are they coming from? Well, in this case, we can look at the thing from an atomic perspective. We can ask ourselves, what is the valence of plutonium? What are the plutonium atom doing in the solid? So this was so the cartoon. We fluctuated between four states when we had the Haber model. So we had S electrons, we only had four states. In plutonium, there are many, 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 many body states. But the interesting thing is that not all of them are occupied. And if you look at it as a function of time, what you find is that essentially five F electron states and six F electron states are appreciably populated. And we can contrast that with another material, for example, curium, which is the particle hole analog. Plutonium has five, curium has seven F electrons, so you would have thought that they are very similar, but they are not. In curium, the atom always has seven electrons. It doesn't fluctuate at all. And here, the notion of valence, of chemical valence, makes perfect sense. You always live in one configuration. While when you have plutonium, you fluctuate between many, many different states of five and six F electrons. That's what's called mixed valence condition. And that's the reason why the elastic properties of this material is so strange, because the two valences have very, very different sizes, and you're fluctuating between these two, which give rise to lots of anomalies. So once more, you see that this technique not only allows you to sort of see the same thing, by see, I mean, quote unquote, the same thing that experimentally see, but it also allows you to understand it, because you can get a very vivid picture in terms of something that you can grasp with your hands. Because you know that solids are made out of atoms, but because it's in a solid, the atom will fluctuate between many different many body states, and we can see which many body states are important and what are their properties. Okay, and then we can also look at the photoemission, and there also here there was clear fingerprints that looked like an experiment. That was sort of the experiment, and that was sort of the calculations, and it looks similar. Okay, so as the last exhibit, just to conclude this talk, I'd like to go to a problem which is still not understood, just to show you how we can use the dynamic amine field theory to ask questions about the copper oxides, the high temperature superconductors, and how we can start asking very fundamental questions with this method. So let me remind you of the introduction. I started in some sense with this phase diagram where we have doping on one axis and temperature on the other, and we have high temperature superconductivity in some region, we have magnetism, and this problem has been around for 30 years and is still the subject of very, very active discussion. People don't agree on, we know what the materials are made of, so we have no problems knowing basically what are the atoms. The atoms are copper and oxygen, which form layers of copper and oxygen. These are sort of some of the structures. But there's no agreement on how to think about the problem and what causes this high temperature superconductivity here. And there are various schools of thought. There are some people who think that what's going on here is that you have some sort of quasi-particles, and then the spins make some glue that binds the quasi-particles into Cooper pairs. So here I drew a wave with wave vector k and one with minus k, and you sort of glue the two states together to form a Cooper pair that then both condenses and superconducts. And there are a different school of thought going back to Phil Anderson, who says, no, in these materials, the superconductivity has nothing to do with gluing quasi-particles, gluing waves with opposite momenta together, but it's better to think in terms of the spins, and the spins form what is called a spin liquid, which is free to move around. And then when you put holes in a spin liquid, then what happens is that this becomes a superconductor. And then there's, of course, the question how to describe this normal state above TC, which is nothing but normal. It doesn't fit to the standard model of solids. And there's the question of understanding the differences between families. So what's plotted in this diagram is two different types of high-temperature superconductors. They share the same type of copper oxide layer, but they're slightly different. I mean, and their phase diagram is different. And if you really understand something, you should explain not only what's similar, that both have superconductivity and magnetism, but what is different. And in this case, the magnetism is very robust. Well, here the magnetism dies very, very quickly. And one important difference is that here the copper is coordinated by an octahedron of oxygen. So there's an oxygen on top. Here there's no oxygen on top. So there are differences. So all those questions are questions that now with the modern dynamic amine field technology we can start addressing. But to put things in perspective, I'd like to discuss some of the early formulations of the resonant valence bond theory, because they were to some degree successful and had some predictive power. And here the idea is you need to introduce two order parameters, one for measuring how well you form the singlets, and another one to measure whether the singlets can be coherent or not. And when we did that mean field theory back in the 80s, what we found is various things that had not been seen at the time experimentally, such as the D-wave symmetry of the order parameter and the shape of this dome. All this was done in 1988 when none of these things were clear. We had here a regime where the electron was very incoherent. It was not a wave. And basically, we had a pseudo gap because it was spin pairing. And it was more or less things that later on experimentalists found. And basically, very few people believe in this. But also, with wave function approaches, which are zero temperature approaches, you can get this, and was done also by Maurice Rice at the same time. So the reason why I bring this here is because it gives you some idea what we could do in the 1988. When we only had static order parameters to try to describe these ideas of spin pairing and coherence-incoherence crossover, which now we can do with a more modern mean field methods. And sort of just to put things in perspective, this is sort of a quote from Phil Anderson. This Phil is sort of very controversial, in which he says, well, I mean, it's been my published opinion that we know what high temperature superconductivity comes from. We have a workable theory. And it's basically a crude version of this theory. It was done by Zhang and also was done by Liu and myself. And essentially, that's sort of some zeroth order understanding in the sense that it was predictive because, as Phil says, the successes weren't recognized because experiments at that time were too primitive. I almost agree with that. I will only make a couple of changes in this description of the cuprate problem. I would say we don't have a workable theory. And I would say that it was really the theory that was too primitive, in the sense that we sort of had the right ideas that any theory of correlated materials has to incorporate the ability to pair spins. And this idea of coherent incoherent crossover, but I think it's really the dynamical mean field theory which is the right framework in which to try to formulate this and to link to the simpler picture of gluing electrons with spin fluctuations in the weak correlation limit. And so let me show you now very briefly how we do that in the last part of the talk. Now, instead of taking a single site, we need to take a plaquette of sites. We need to take 4 sites in order to just to get this spin pairing properly into account. And the medium now can be either magnetic or superconducting. If you do that, and that was first worked out by Sacha Lichtenstein, you get a phase diagram which is qualitatively similar to the high-TC phase diagram. As a generic phase diagram, as a toy model, like I showed you the toy model, the phase diagram of the Haber model on a single-site DMFT. Now, if we do, but we can really investigate what's going on. We can extract the physics, again, by looking at the histograms. And let's do, for example, dynamical mean field theory with 2 sites. Then we have the empty site, we have the singlet of 2 spins, we have a triplet, and we have quasi-particle states with 1 electron. We can see how we evolve at the function of doping, and we can see that this model really likes to form a law of singlets. So this is basically all the possible states. You fluctuate between all the possible configurations of the singlet, and you see that there's a lot of tendency to form singlets near this mod insulating state. You can also look at it in moment, and then a high doping, you have an ordinary Fermi liquid, which we understand. You can look at it also from the photoemission point of view in momentum space, and a large doping, you have nice Fermi surface. This is a photoemission at 0 frequency, so the place where it's red is where there are quasi-particles. Here, the quasi-particles live on a Fermi surface. Here, the quasi-particles live on an arc. And all that comes just from 4 sites, by just doing a simple mean field theory, unbiased in 4 sites. And it sort of gives you a much more sophisticated cartoon of the cuprates than we had back in the 80s. But we don't have to stop there. We can really analyze how we gain energy, how do we superconduct. Because we can do something very important. We can compare the spin energy in a normal mean field state and in a superconducting mean field state and see if we lower the energy or not. So this is sort of this difference, this exchange energy. I can follow the normal state, and I can follow the superconducting state, and I can see the energy gain. And that is extremely important because I can only do a mean field theory. If you want to understand the mechanism of anything in any of the strongly correlated electrons, you need a mean field theory to look at a normal state and an order state, in this case a superconducting state, at the same temperature with the same method. And it's basically this difference and the physical origin of this difference which tells you something about the mechanism. And here we have nailed the mechanism. It's just that the superconductor can pair the spins much better than the normal state. Well, much better, by a small amount. This energy is relatively small, but it's sufficient to give rise to high temperature superconductivity, just like it was surmised in the original RVB ansatz. But we can do more. We can now calculate correlation functions, and we can calculate the correlation functions that are measured in neutron spectroscopy. This is the susceptibility, and we can do the same thing that experimentalists do. This is the how the spin fluctuations are distributed in frequency near an important part of the zone. This is in the normal state, and when you go superconducting, you're transferring weight, and you can see how much you're transferring, and you can do these integrals and get this energy, and ask yourself whether this looks like what the experimentalists see. And it's remarkably similar. At very high temperatures, the susceptibility is featureless. As you start lowering the temperature, you're forming two peaks, just like in the theory. And it's basically this difference between the spin correlation function, which is giving rise in the mean field theory to the gain in energy. Okay, I have to sort of wrap this up. I'd like to sort of now convince you of one more thing. We can actually do that not only for toy models, we can do that for real materials. So I was curious, why is this LASCO and this NCCO different from each other? So we ran the calculation for the two materials. And let me explain what we do here. We're doing what's called single site and two site calculations. And what you find is that when you're doing NCCO, the one site and the two site gives identical magnetizations as a function of doping. So here, you declare victory. That means that with two sites, we can describe actually this material. And those are the experimental points. So that's extremely good. For the whole dope, for the LASCO, the single site is here, the two site is there. So you see that here neither one is sufficient, but you see that the magnetization is decreasing very fast as you increase the cluster size. So here the conclusion is that the magnetism is not robust. And that's exactly what you see experimentally. In NCCO, magnetism is very robust. In LASCO, this is not robust. It falls very, very quickly. And you can trace that to the chemistry of the material. And let me explain briefly where it's that. We can trace this big difference to the fact that one guy has an extra oxygen atom on top. It's this one, and this one doesn't. So I don't have time to explain this, but I'd like to sort of summarize the talk by telling you sort of what was sort of the big picture of this. In the cuprate superconductors, we ask, what's the zeroth order thing? What's the smallest model we can solve with this technique that gives us the physics of the cuprates? And with four sites, we can sort of get, in a more or less unbiased way, all the phenomenology of the material. And then we can start understanding why there are some subtle differences between the compounds. And we can also sort of see that where high-temperature superconductivity begins to emerge. And it begins to emerge in a region where the electron is neither itinerant nor localized. So this is, again, Murphy's law, that interesting physics happens when perturbation theory fails more catastrophically. So that's basically the conclusion for cuprates. And sort of now taking one step back, what's sort of the big picture in sort of understanding materials? Well, dynamical mean field theory is giving us two things. It's giving us tools to think about what's going on, and it's giving us computational power to extract what's happening to the electrons in actual materials. So it's like a reference frame. It's like an harmonic oscillator, if you want. The electron, the plaquette in a medium or the single site in a medium is the simplest frame in which to start doing perturbation theory if you hope to reach the actual materials. And the interesting thing is that it's the only non-Gaussian reference frame I know of in sort of theoretical physics. All the other reference frames like are essentially collections of harmonic oscillators, and this is not. This is an interacting non-Gaussian reference frame. And we can do wonderful things. We can actually understand mechanisms. We can compare different orders, different states. All the things you do in classical stat-mech, we can do in the quantum version. And then we can really understand physics. We can understand mechanisms for magnetic order, superconducting order, etc. We can bridge between atomic information and physical properties. We did it for plutonium, we did it for the 115s, we did it for the cuprates. When you start bridging between structure and property, you start learning, and when you learn, eventually perhaps you may be able to design. And we got, there are many, many groups using this method, and now it's a whole industry, and it's making progress very, very fast, and there are many examples of successes where you really understand experiments at a deeper level as a result of just having experiments plus this technique. In the meanwhile, the experimentalists, again, they're always ahead, and now they have new arenas in which to study correlated electron problems. They're building much more complicated heterostructures, artificial materials, interfaces. Just like after people understood bulk silicon, they started to do p-n junctions and they started to do transistors, the same thing is happening with correlated electrons. So always the bar will be higher for the theorists. So, but on the other hand, I believe that we are sort of in the right path, that we have some sort of compass to orient ourselves in the space of all materials. But if you really want to do that, we need to develop the method a lot more to move in this area rather than the compass. Probably we're going to need something like this gizmo, like a GPS, because the complexity of these systems are increasing a lot. But still, I think that in a few years, we will sort of try to work closely with experimentalists in an effort to understand and ultimately perhaps to find more interesting materials for the future. And as sort of some parting thought, I'd like to sort of mention a mythical figure in this search for interesting materials, search for high-temperature superconductors, was Bernd Mathias. And he had actually some set of rules for how to find interesting superconductors. And with those rules, he found over 200 superconductors. And before the cuprates, he had the record of finding high-temperature superconductivity. And the rules were actually quite simple. And it says that you needed to just look at metals, and the electron metals were good, but you always had to stay away from oxides. Now we know this rule was completely wrong. The high temperature superconductivity was found in copper oxides. Now the limit is 160 Kelvin, and therefore this was not a good heuristic for finding good materials. Now, the other rule he had is that you had to look for cubic systems because those were the best. And again, the interesting high-temperature superconductors like the cuprates and the nictites happen in planar structures. So cubic is actually not good for finding high-temperature superconductivity. That rule was wrong. The other rule he had is that you have to look at densities where you have peaks of the densities at the Fermi level. And again, in the cuprates rather than peaks, you actually, or in the nictites, it's quite clear that you have dips of the density of states. So you have basically, this is again completely misleading. The last rule, which is sort of the most famous one, is that you had to stay away from theorists. And until now, this rule is the only one that holds, but I hope that not for the close future, even though, I mean, Zach Fisk, who was a student of Bernd Mathias, tells me that there's actually one more rule that was not written, but he always told his students, and that you should not follow my rules. So perhaps in this note, I mean, this one will prove to be right at the end. Thank you.